From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, an extended interview with one of the most successful musicians of his generation, Ray Davis of the Kinks, on his music, his career, the British invasion, and his fascination with the United States.
We'd had four or five big records in America all over the world. Among them, Tired of Waiting, You Really Got Me All Down All of the Night. Then we suddenly imposed this ban on us. So it was grabbing back what was we felt was considered to be our prime.
That's Ray Davis talking about his new book, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story. It's coming up on this special edition of FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff. The U.S. government says it is working to verify the authenticity of a videotape that appears to show the beheading of American journalist Stephen Sotloff by Islamic State militants. Mr. Sotloff's family have gathered in Miami, where they are reportedly grieving just 5 days after his mother issued a televised appeal urging the Islamic State to show her son mercy. Also on the video, the group threatens the life of a British hostage. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
Stephen Sotloff's killer is the same British-accented militant who murdered James Foley 2 weeks ago. "I'm back, Obama," says the man on the video, once again blasting the White House for its campaign of airstrikes against the militants. And the film features another detainee, David Haynes of Britain, on his knees in an orange jumpsuit, the next captive threatened with murder by Islamic State. The White House has condemned the video as horrific and says U.S. intelligence is now working to verify its authenticity. Simon Marks, Washington.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has condemned the murder of Mr. Sotloff as disgusting. Our London correspondent Ali Barrett says pressure is mounting on Mr. Cameron's government to identify the British-accented killer of Mr. Sotloff and James Foley.
With a British national seemingly involved in two murders of American citizens, he is under increasing pressure now at home and abroad to do something. And this latest development comes just ahead of a major NATO summit taking place in Wales, which gets underway on Thursday, with the Islamic State certain to be discussed by leaders.
UN officials are preparing to investigate atrocities on a massive scale in Iraq, as human rights groups warn of a brutal campaign by Islamic State militants to rid northern Iraq of its minorities. FSN's Nina Maria Potts is in Erbil.
More than 1,400 people were killed in Iraq in August alone. More than a million have been displaced by what the UN is calling acts of inhumanity on an unimaginable scale. UN officials are preparing to investigate what Amnesty International is describing as a wave of ethnic cleansing.
The Pentagon says the U.S. is still trying to assess whether an airstrike in Somalia killed the head of the al-Shabaab militant group. FSN's Daniel Wrenches has that story.
Somali officials say the strikes on vehicles took place in a forest about 100 miles south of the capital, Mogadishu, where al-Shabaab trains fighters. The Associated Press is reporting that six militants were killed, but so far there's no confirmation about whether the group's leader, Ahmed Abdi Gudane, who has a $7 million US bounty on his head, was among them.
The FBI is investigating allegations that hackers posted naked pictures of several prominent Hollywood celebrities online. Meanwhile, Apple says it's looking into the possibility that accounts with its iCloud service were hacked in a bid to find those images. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. More now on the FBI's investigation into those hacked celebrity pictures. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Kate Fisher reports.
It's understood some of the images were obtained from services such as the Apple iCloud that backs up content from devices onto the internet. Apple says it's investigating. An FBI spokesman told the Associated Press news agency that it was aware of the allegations and was addressing the matter. Cybersecurity expert Ed Hardy says that this level of investigation is rare in cases like this.
The first thing to say is it's not very typical. It is just very interesting that celebrities are getting this level of response. Actually doing something about it is going to be another matter.
A list of those who've allegedly been hacked apparently includes Kat Deeley, Kim Kardashian and Rihanna. Kate Fisher, Washington.
The first vaccine trials are underway by medical researchers trying to find a cure for the Ebola virus. 20 healthy adult volunteers are participating in a study at America's National Institutes of Health in Maryland. A German court has temporarily imposed a nationwide ban on the private taxi provider Uber. The ruling is another setback for the San Francisco-based company's expansion plans in Germany. From FSN's Berlin bureau, Ira Spitzer reports.
A regional court in Frankfurt has said Uber must pay fines of 250,000 euros if it continues to operate in Germany. A German taxi company is the plaintiff in the case, and it has accused Uber of unfair competition. The case against Uber is that its drivers and vehicles do not meet adequate safety and insurance standards. Last week, the company announced that it was seeking to expand aggressively in Germany. The judge's ruling will remain in effect at least until Uber's upcoming hearing on the matter. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
There is more from us on Twitter. You can follow us there at Feature Story. That is the latest Feature Story news. Priscilla Huff reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, an extended interview with one of the world's most successful rock musicians, Ray Davis of the Kinks. They exploded onto the scene in 1963, became part of the original British invasion that also brought the Beatles and the Rolling Stones to America, and became one of the most influential rock groups of the era. Ray Davis has a new book, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story. And he talked about his life with Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio.
They called it the Invaders when we first went there. And unfortunately, we got banned for 4 years in America. So during that time, I wrote very English songs. I wrote songs like Days, Sunny Afternoon, Village Green Preservation Society and Waterloo Sunset. But we didn't really get to America. We were forgotten. And then suddenly we got the ban lifted and went there to tour.
How did the ban come about? I see conflicting stories about how that happened.
Well, I think it's to do with unions. Remember, we went there in the early days of the British invasion and things weren't so organised. The Kinks were... Well, we had attitude problems. I think it's a mixture of bad business, bad management, bad behaviour.
Quite a combination, really. Yeah. Do you think it's almost... You have to have a bit of that, though, to be a success, particularly maybe in the 60s. There has to be a bit of an attitude.
I think attitude comes... Yeah, attitude. Well, you still get bands with attitude, like Oasis. Yeah. There's lots of new bands. I think so many bands are manufactured now, and I think occasionally a band breaks through, literally because of its own energy, its own magnetism. And in those days, the Kinks would never have got signed. I was not considered to be lead singer material. And I think we had to force punch our way into the music business. You really got me, you know. When it came out, it sounded like nothing else on the radio, so we punched our way into it.
I was watching something on the internet last night about that, and sort of it was seen as sort of the first quite naughty song, wasn't it? Sort of, it certainly wasn't about holding naughty. Hands.
Naughty?
Well, just sort of a bit raunchy.
Yeah, it was, well, for those days, more conservative times, it was a bit raunchy, yeah. Very direct in its intent.
When you watch programmes now, and maybe you don't watch them, but like sort of X Factor and things like that, do you want to just tear your hair out at it? Because they almost guaranteed to sell a huge number of records, and you think, well, back in the 60s, we used to really have to work for what we achieved.
Yeah, it's a different kind of industry. It's become an industry, you know. The music business was in its early years in Britain when the Kinks broke through. And now it's become bigger and bigger as an industry and more manufactured. So it's part and parcel of the modern world, really.
And it's about fame now rather than the music.
It's about doing whatever you can to get on TV, no matter how much you're humiliated. I often think, you know, I do songwriting courses for new writers, and I like to get the losers of X Factor and develop them into something. Because I think the Kinks would have failed on X Factor.
Well, that was kind of my point, in that there must be dozens, hundreds of really good bands or singers out there who never get the break nowadays that they might have got 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's it also affects the sort of music that people aspire to write. I'm not being overcritical, but I think to get on those programmes, you have to develop a style of writing that suits the judges. And being in music and young music is all about forging your own destiny. And I think there's a loss with a lot of new bands where they're pandering to the tastes of other people.
What do you like most about America?
Carrying on from the first question, went back to America. Last time we played there, we played in front of 15,000 people. But we went back and played about 200 or 300 people in a club. So it was a building process. What do I like about it? I think it's not like so much. It fascinates me because of its size and the different cultures in America. But also the music that inspired me when I was a kid, you know, blues, country, jazz, and R&B. I think that's what drew me to America.
Because you said somewhere, and I can't remember where this was, that you're writing as somebody from London, not from South California, whereas, of course, sort of a lot of the most successful songs in America obviously were written by people who are Native Americans. But your songs a lot of them became massive hits there. They translated into America in a way that maybe some others didn't.
I know. The song Come Dancing was a Kinks hit, and the record company in America didn't want to put it out because I was singing in a London accent. I said, well, it's about a London dance hall owner. It'd be strange if I sang in an American accent, Come Dancing. So against his better judgment, he put it out, and lo and behold, it became a really big hit in America.
They put a parking lot on a piece of land where the supermarket used to stand. Before that, they put up a bowling alley on the site that used to be the local pally. That's where the big band used to come and play. My sister went there on a Saturday. Come dancing. All our boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural.
How important was fame in America to you? Or success rather than fame, maybe?
It was to do with taking back what had been taken away from us. You know, we'd had 4 or 5 big records in America all over the world, among them Tired of Waiting, You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night. Then we suddenly imposed this ban on us. So it was grabbing back what we felt was considered to be our prime. And it took 10 years to do it. We finally made it back, and the book explains that in some detail. And eventually made it back to Madison Square Garden, home.
Which is kind of a good place to be, I guess.
It's a good place to be, but, you know, the 200 or 300 seater clubs were good too. It's all part of that journey.
I know one or two singers who say they actually get much more satisfaction out of performing to an audience of that size because of its intimacy than some sort of massive stadium. It's an entirely different experience.
It is. You know, when you're on tour with a large entourage, as we eventually built out into stadiums and things, you rely on other people to hear your sound, monitor man to hear your drums, and you lose contact with what you really sound like. But in a small club, you can use the dynamics of a club and work with the audience, and a lot of my songs are lyrically driven, so it's important to get that contact with the audience.
And you've also got a tremendous range of repertoire, haven't you? Sort of from the rock songs to the ballads. Which do you sort of prefer writing?
Well, the lyrically driven songs are more like stories. You Really Got Me. If I had to rewrite that now, I'm not sure how I could have done it. It'd probably be too wordy. To be fair, the lyrics on You Really Got Me were just there to fulfil a role. Girl, You Really Got Me Going. Yeah, okay. Then Change Key, say the same thing. And it's a chat-up song, really.
Where Where did Days come from? That's my favourite of yours. I just think it's a fabulous song.
Days came, I bought a second-hand upright piano that I really liked, and I was tinkering on it, and it was almost church chords to start with, and holding pedal notes and just going round three chords, and it just came out, really, and I wanted a big chord change going from D to B-flat. So it wrote, sometimes they write themselves. I'm constantly thinking, you know, I have my own musical soundtrack in the book. Again, I talk about my own musical soundtrack that communicates me with the world. So it was a soundtrack song in my head, and then one day it just came out. There's no secret to writing it. It was thought about a lot. And then,
but it's such a distinct sound in that song. I mean, I can't even articulate what I mean by that, but it's also, going back to what we're talking about Southern California, it could have been written by someone from there, couldn't it? Which I guess means that explains why it was so successful in the States.
Yeah, well, I think it's the chord structure is slightly, the verse goes round like a Southern California song, then it hits that, the bridge, and that's, I think, purely British, English. And probably from when I was in the choir at school. And
I can't imagine you in a choir somewhere.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was in the crooners. My best friend couldn't sing, and I wanted to sort of hang out with him, so I deliberately sang out of tune. My choir master said, I know you're doing it, Davis, but it's very talented, a lot of talent to be able to sing that much out of tune.
I can do it perfectly naturally. All right. What's the most rock and roll thing you've ever done?
Rock and roll.
Well, you know what I mean. Smashing up a hotel room or sort of.
Well, we did go in for that. Yeah, I think I observe rock and roll moments, and I remember in the book I talk about my brother meeting Keith Moon, who was a drummer with the Who, in Chicago, and they're watching them desperately squeeze the television out of the window, but the window frame wasn't big enough, and they broke up the television so they could throw bits out. Pretty stupid behaviour. There's all sorts of stories like motorbikes being driven into swimming pools and rock and roll thing. I think the most rock and roll thing I've done recently is come through the traffic to get here tonight. It's quite heavy out there.
Always a challenge. You should have got that black cab that you rolled up into the Olympic Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
Now, that must have been an amazing night.
That was interesting. It seemed good in theory, but just before I went on, we had just one battery pack on to communicate us with the front of house. And my microphone busted. And I said, I can't go on. They said, you've got to go on. It's live. And so they actually pushed me into the cab. And as I fell into the cab, the cab jolted forward and my battery pack slipped into the floor and actually reconnected itself.
Oh, really?
So it was,
thank goodness for that.
Yeah. So
I remember watching that and it was... I can sort of remember the skyline. It was just, I mean, I'm sure you've watched it back since then, but it was just such an evocative moment and quite an emotional moment as well.
Yeah. You know, I haven't seen it.
Have you not?
No.
Get the video. DVD, sorry. I'm living in the 80s.
Yeah. I'll have a look at it one day. Yeah. It was a great moment. Yeah. And time, you know, it was organised chaos, but I must say they worked it very well.
Ray, clearly, you've got a sort of love for America. Which part of America that you visited do you find most affinity with?
We signed to a label in New York called Arista Records years ago when we came back. And we
signed a silver label, didn't they?
Yeah, Arista.
Yeah.
And Clive Davis's label. So he encouraged me to rent an apartment on the west side of New York, and I stayed there on and off for about 8 years. But I ended up on my journey. I went to New Orleans after a tour. I did a tour after 9/11, a week or so after. And because the flights were all disrupted, we travelled across America by car a lot. So it was my first American road trip, really.
And that's fascinating to do, isn't it?
Yeah, very tiring as well. And it made me realise the source of my music influences came from the South, the Mississippi and New Orleans. So after that tour, I started going down to New Orleans and looking for places to stay there, rented places and stayed in B&Bs and things. And it was, the culture down there interested me. I didn't realise it was quite dangerous.
I was going to say, because in 2004 you had a bit of an unfortunate experience.
Yeah, I was mugged. I was out with somebody, a friend, and they stole her bag and ran off. And being a fool, and I ran after him and nearly caught him, and he shot me. He really shot me.
I suspect that's not the first time you've used that line. And what was the upshot of that?
The upshot was incredible pain, and while in hospital, and again in the book, go into that in some detail. It's cathartic to write about it. It made me feel, because I shut it out my, it was 2004, and I shut it out my mind afterwards when I came back. I resumed recording and touring, but it had an effect on me. It was not so much what happened, but why it happened. Maybe it's a sign that I should change things. And I had started a music project down there with a marching band from the local schools. So I was going to try and persevere and do that, but it stopped that. So I came back to the UK and abandoned my American journey. But it was a learning curve for me. But there were some great people in the hospitals there, desperately poor part of the world. Mm. When you think America's the most powerful, or was, most powerful country in the world, there's real desperately poor people there.
What do you think of the London of today compared with the London that you grew up in?
Obviously more mixed people, it's more culturally diverse, but I miss some of the neighbourliness. I think people are maybe frightened to meet with their neighbours and mix with people. It's more isolated communities now.
Now, I've got to ask you this. I bet you get asked this in every single interview you do, so I'm not going to be very original, but obviously...
Who is Lola?
No.
Oh.
I know who Lola is. I think I do anyway.
Well, he's sitting in the other room.
What, transvestite in the other room? Yeah, that's probably about right. The Kinks split in 1996. There have been lots of rumours about sort of whether you might ever get back together again. Is it ever going to happen?
Right now it's unlikely, but it's to do with the music, and particularly work I do with my family member and the band. It's to do with camaraderie. You know, the Kinks were not great individual musicians, but as a band we were incredible when we got going together. And it's so much in Americana I talk about when I split with the band. I didn't never split. I'm still waiting for the phone to ring for another gig. But when I parted company with the band, I found it difficult to replace some of the players, the style I like to work with. So so much depends on whether there's a spirit and a communal sort of understanding of where music's at.
What was the tensions that there inevitably were within the band? Were they a good thing for the Kinks? Because, I mean, the fallouts with your brother were fairly well, your brother Dave, were fairly well documented in some ways, make the rivalry between Liam and Noel Gallagher seem rather mild.
Yeah.
But did that lead to creative tension or just destructive tension?
Certainly when I used to produce the records with the Kinks after a couple of the first singles, and I had an understanding with the engineer I worked with, get ready with the record button, because I'd show my brother the chords and say, do it, run the playback machine, and he'd do it first time. If he didn't get it first or second time, it would take all day, sometimes a few days. So you learn to sort of spirit in some fire, and a bit of aggression is good sometimes with players, and the drummer too, Mick, on drums. And a little bit of a panic, press the panic button, and he plays a stunning fill. So it's to do with, it's being like a football coach, really. You know, run faster, relax. And it's very unmusical, but maybe it worked for us.
I was watching a video yesterday of you playing at Glastonbury in 2010, and it was the day after your best friend, band member Pete Quaife, died. And the emotion when you were singing Days was, I mean, almost had me going. It must have been an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Well, I got the news the night before, late the night before that show at Glastonbury, And I thought, I must say something about Pete, and I picked that. But that was the last song Pete ever recorded with us, actually. So
that's quite a good one to go out
on. Yeah, only on the recording box, he spelled it D-A-Z-E. And, but anyway, I got onto the stage at Glastonbury. I said, this will be a no-brainer. I'll just announce Pete's passing. And then I said it, and I saw the people, and I heard the choir singing behind me, and did all I could not to sort of lose it.
Thank you for the days. Those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days. I won't forget a single day, believe me. I bless the light. I bless the light that shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me.
What would you like? I mean, you've achieved an incredible amount in your life so far. Is there anything that you feel unfulfilled by?
I love to write new music, and I've written lots of songs. There's lots of new songs on this album. I've used the lyrics anyway. I want to do that record. And there's an opera nagging away inside me. I don't know
an
why.
Opera? Yeah, really?
I don't know why I put myself through this.
That would be quite a departure, wouldn't it?
It would be a departure, but we'll see what the journey, how it goes, how the doors open for me. But I do set myself sort of tasks. Going back to the book, I talk about the period when we were in the wilderness back in America, and I wrote concept albums, and I wrote soap operas, and a musical called Preservation that we actually took on the road with singers and horn sections, and that was operatic. I'd like to turn that into a real opera.
See, I always think opera is lovely music interrupted by screeching.
Yeah, but I'll try and minimise that.
We've only got about a minute and a half left. I just want to finish off by asking you about Waterloo Sunset, because, I mean, we're a London station. It's consistently voted the best song about London. Where did it come from? How long did it take to write?
Literally came... Well, I've had an interesting relationship with Waterloo when I used to be an art student. I did time at Croydon Art School while I was waiting for my next place at Central School. And I used to get the train, the Northern Line, down to Waterloo there. Then I was hospitalised briefly at Waterloo, at St Thomas's. And I suppose when it came to me in a dream, really, I woke up singing this song. And the first thing that crossed my mind was make it Liverpool Sunset, as the demise of Merseybeat. But then I sat down at the piano and the lyrics just went easy. It's just easy peasy. And it's just came out. And probably I'm not being totally honest. Sometimes the songs linger a while and I make notes. But I can't recall actually making many notes on that. I still like to re-record it.
That's Ray Davis talking there to Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio. His book, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story, is published by Stirling. And that's FSN Reports for today. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. Goodbye.